And before I come to my sort of third section and return to Blake and think a little bit more about Blake's imaginative states of mind, he has a whole kind of schema, which is what I wanted to offer, because I think it helps us to navigate our way through different kinds of imagination. But I might just pause there because just to make sure that this is still working for everybody, but also because there might be one or two questions that help clarify things from what I've said so far that would be useful at this point. We gradually solve that puzzle. Our sense of the imagination and what it can see and do expands. So, you know, you can read his poetry and often instantly get something out of it. You know, like the wise man and the fool don't see the same tree. And, you know, there's lots of quotes of Blake's that have made it into the popular imagination. But particularly his epic poems and his more complex imagery, he does ask you to work at it, because it's in the working that your imagination is trained and discerned, and you can step through one-fold, two-fold, three-fold to four-fold vision. So what I thought I could do now is just sort of describe these four steps and hopefully give you a sense of how this does happen to us sort of all day, every day. And so the task is really one of using his schema to notice what state of imagination we're in so that we can gradually cultivate and be freer to move across different states of imagination. And as it were, not just see the Guinea sun rising in the morning, but see the heavenly hosts. So the first state, which, you know, someone I've alluded to in that first picture of the House of Death with Urizen, is he called it the state of Ulro, which is U-L-R-O. And if you want a kind of a strap line for Ulro, it's the state that loves reason, hence the god Urizen presiding over it. It believes the world reality is engaged by measuring things, for example, or it trusts abstractions like laws of nature or generalizations. It feels that rules are probably the truest thing. It trusts statistics as well. You know, if you were going to have an all-ro type education, it's really about how just to pass the exams with the greatest percentage. It's, you know, as mechanical as possible, just to kind of get you through the exam. And similarly, wisdom really is based on calculations and good evidence. So someone in an all-ro state of mind, when you ask them, you know, what's the correct answer, they say, you know, let's get more evidence, or let's make a better calculation. It's that kind of approach. Now, this isn't automatically a bad thing. For Blake, Ulro can be a very helpful state of mind to be in. So for example, if you go into a panic, then you're quite likely to regress to an Ulro state because it promises quite a lot of safety. And I think that in the COVID pandemic, you could say, there's been a lot of Ulro around, turning to statistics, we want to know the rules, you know, are we supposed to wear a mask or not? We want more evidence to be gathered so we know the truth of COVID-19. And there's clearly a lot in that. But Blake's critique always is that it's not that one state is necessarily bad in itself, but what is bad is getting stuck in single vision and Newton's sleep. That's why it puts you to sleep if you get stuck in single vision. And in particular, it doesn't even know that it's using the imagination to generate its abstractions and generalizations and laws. It thinks imagination is deluded and fantastical. So it's not very self-aware, this Ulro state. It doesn't really know what to do with things like suffering or death. You know, they're best avoided, really. And again, in the COVID crisis, you've seen that with, you know, flatten the curve. This dominant desire just to reduce the numbers of people who are dying. And look, clearly there's something in that, but there must be more to suffering and death for we human beings, and Ulro can't really access that. It's just bewildered if you ask what death means. Freedom's really about control. The more control you have, the freer Ulro would say you are. Life is sort of machine-like in Ulro. And again, you know, if you're having a heart valve operation, you probably want quite a lot of Ulro to be around. But if you view your heart just as a machine, then clearly you're going to lose out on more in life as well. So let me just show this one image again, which is one of his most famous depictions of Ulro. I hope you can see that now. This is Newton in Newton's sleep, measuring the world. His compasses there, they limit things as much as they measure things. You know, Newton can only, as it were, see between the two points of his compass there. He can't see the world around him. And the world around him, therefore, has sort of almost disappeared in a kind of gloomy, it looks like he's at the bottom of the sea. The darkness is the rest of reality. And it looks like a, well, there is life there, but it's kind of spooky life. He can't really make much sense of it, even if he could see it. So that's one of Blake's famous images of this Ulro state, single vision and Newton's sleep. So now let's come to the second state. This is the state of generation. Now, if Ulro had loved reason, generation loves reproduction. I think you can summarize it like that. And again, there's good and bad in this. The good is that it can see there's such a thing as life, and that life must reproduce to go on. There's more life, you might say. But the risk is that that reproduction descends into mindless replication. And sometimes I think you see the ambiguity of generation if you go into a supermarket, because on the one hand, it's a joy to see lots of different kinds of food. And you know, you think of what it's taken to reproduce that food. But then you go down the cereals aisle and you realize that there's just dozens of different kinds of cereal for no real reason other than just brand extension. And that's reproduction, I think, descending into mere replication. And, you know, our consumer culture is full of that ambiguity now. There's a joy in all that we can enjoy in life, but there's something a bit degenerate about it as well, which maybe you often feel. So this mix goes on throughout this state of generation. You know, it trusts longevity, it trusts health. It would say you've got to keep fit. But it talks about those things mostly in terms of just surviving, extending life, and doesn't really have much a sense of quality of life. It finds that hard to talk about. Quantity of life is really what counts. Education, you might say, has moved on a bit. It would enjoy problem solving. It can apply principles rather than just generalizations and abstract laws, but it's a bit clever at the same time. If you see someone who's wise in generation, you might think they're smart, but they don't really seem to speak much from the heart. And after a while, it starts to feel a bit empty. You know, they might talk about prisoners' dilemmas in ethics, or talk about the world as a zero-sum game. And it's something in it, but you know, you feel it's not quite getting to the grips with things somehow as well. I think that generation does know that it has imagination, but imagination is more about persuading or manipulating, sort of wooing you. So marketeers have this kind of imagination, and they want to sort of seduce you with their products by building up their brands through imagination. So they can be very good at that. It can be, in a way, very imaginative. But imagination itself is constrained, and so it doesn't have the full lease of life that you're going to find in threefold and fourfold vision. Suffering and death are seen a bit differently in generation. They're not just bewildering to be avoided if possible. They're now seen as sort of travesties that ideally will be remedied. And so in generation, medicine, particularly biological-based medicine, really takes off because it recognizes that suffering and death are travesties, and so it will use its imagination to try and remedy that. Blake also called this state the vegetative state, vegetation. If you ever read the word vegetation in Blake, he's talking about generation, because with no disrespect to the plants and trees, he saw this as a bit like the ivy, perhaps, that unchecked just kind of keeps growing over everything and will, you know, tear down even your concrete building given half a chance. So there's something a bit Triffid-like about generation left unchecked. But it's also about life. It is about life and it is about reproduction. And the figure in Blake's poetry who you often see caught in a state of generation is this chap, who I hope you can see now. This is Loss. And Loss here is shown in two forms, actually. He's shown with the naked full frontal view and then also with his rear view, carrying the sun, carrying the light. This shows the two sides of reproduction or generation. There is the one side that can carry the light into the world, but there's also the other side that gets a bit obsessed just with making stuff. So Loss has his hammer and he has his compass there. He's often in his fiery furnaces making things. He forges Golgonooza in generation, and it's not a worthless activity, but actually in Eden Eternity, Golgonooza doesn't exist. It's like Loss learns something from making Golgonooza, and that learning can be carried into higher states of imagination, but Golgonooza itself doesn't make it there. And the female figure on the right there is Loss's lover or emanation, Enitharmon. And in generation, there is love. There's joining together, but it's for the purposes of reproduction. So they're on sort of opposite sides of the screen, and Blake's very neatly done it. So the sun's on one side and the moon's on the other. So there's a kind of contrary that's in some sort of balance, but they're not commingling. That will happen in a higher state of imagination. And just if you're wondering, the kind of Stonehenge looking like structures, Blake thought that these megaliths were built by druids, as was the wisdom of the time. What's changed now is he was rather down on druids. He thought that druids indulged in human sacrifice. So normally when you see druids, they represent a kind of lesser state of consciousness before self-sacrifice really comes in. You sacrifice someone else in druidic religion, according to Blake. And so that's why the Stonehenge is in this kind of lower state. It's not worthless at all, and it's impressive in its own way, but it hasn't achieved threefold or fourfold vision. It's in this twofold state. So now if I come to the threefold vision, and this is the vision he called Beulah, which is B-E-U-L-A. It comes from the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament Hebrew Bible, where Isaiah, I think it is, says, and the land will be called Beulah. And it means it's wedded to the Lord. It's kind of in covenantal relationship, in loving relationship with God. And so this third state, it's not about reason. It's not about reproduction. It's about relationships. And in Beulah, the safety in love, the safety in support, being understood, empathy, feelings, vulnerability. This is what this imaginative state enables. It enables you to see that there's another person who isn't just part of the working world, but has a soul, has life. It's when I-it relationships turn into I-thou relationships, to use Martin Buber's phrase. It trusts values. It knows the soulfulness. It knows that there's interior life as well as exterior life. Education is about emotional intelligence, about nuance, about art appreciation. Wisdom is a kind of expressiveness. It loves the detail. It knows it has imagination, of course. I mean, generation knew it had imagination, but Beulah knows that imagination isn't just about reproduction, but it's actually about creativity, that the imagination can not just replicate stuff, but can make things that are new. And can share in a higher creativity even. Suffering and death come to be viewed not just as travesties to be avoided, but tragedies that in themselves teach you something about the nature of mortal life. Tragedy will move us both in terms of saddening us, but also making us value life. And so Beulah understands the tragedy of love and life. it's a blissful state as well. Blake thought that Beulah always exists. We can sort of draw on it. We can regress to it, if you like. We can relax in it. You know, maybe a good night's sleep is like Beulah. And let me just show a couple of images that I hope say that in more visual form. Here's one image that I think captures something of Beulah. It's Blake's image that's normally called Friendship. And you can just see the kind of fellow feeling there and the interest in life and the world. You know, the city has got these rays of vitality coming out of it. The path they're following looks like a flowing river. You know, they're co-mingling there in their shared experience there, these friends, as they together look on. There's a lot of lovely life in this image. And here's another image of Beulah that I particularly love, because it comes from Purgatory. Blake did a series of these images where here Dante and Virgil are climbing up the stairs at the side of Mount Purgatory. And they have these kind of resting places where they see across the vast expanse of the sun, of the sea, and they see the sun. They have hope, and they know they're on a journey and it's meaningful. And there's intimacy between Virgil and Dante always. And I think that's a very Beulah state. There are other states that Dante comes across on Purgatory. It can be a very terrifying place as well. But there's these Beulah states that they can return to and find refreshment. So that's a third state, which, you know, we all experience, and it's good to be able to distinguish it and realize that it is one of at least four. It's not one to try and live in for too long, because Blake also felt that love can go wrong. You know, it can flip and turn to hate. It can become envious. It can become moralistic. And I think that that's another thing which we see quite a lot of now, that social media, which in one way is a chance to connect, is the chance to show friendship. When it becomes an end in itself and doesn't have fourfold vision, it's a bit stuck in threefold vision, there's always the risk that it turns and so becomes, you know, aggressive, becomes attacking. You know, it's quite easy to make friends when you have a common enemy. Of itself, Beulah is not enough. And that's why Blake, I think, had the idea of fourfold vision. And he called fourfold vision Eden or eternity, or sometimes Eden eternity. And, you know, if Ulro had loved reason and generation had loved reproduction and Beulah had loved love, then Eden eternity loves life itself in all its manifestations. It has, as it were, the capacity to absorb everything, all the contraries, and because of its powerful imagination, to always be able to transcend whatever life throws at us. So this is the fullness of sight and perception. It's multidimensional. It's able to move across other states of mind. It completely trusts the imagination. It knows that it is the creative source of reality. It knows that it defends what has been and will make what will be. In this state, education is about personal development. It's about using the imagination to make contact with reality as fully as possible. It fosters a wisdom that's based on insight, which is both practical know-how. You know, remember Blake was an engraver. He had tremendous amounts of practical know-how. It's also about your virtues and your character skills, you might say, the kind of person you are. And because if imagination asks you to see that reality is good, beautiful and true at base, you need to be good, beautiful and true to some extent in order to resonate with that so your imagination can pick it up. But imagination is also a pathway to new worlds, you might say. It takes you out of your mind into the world around us, but even takes us into other worlds, like particularly the divine world. You know, hence that image of Job seeing his divine aspect and then also right into the heavens. So suffering and death now becomes transformative because in Eden Eternity, you can see that there's a timelessness to reality, and that life holds death. It's not that life is a kind of random fleeting moment out of eternal death, but rather death is a transitional moment in life, and in particular might well be a transition that takes you from lower to higher states of mind. It's able to kiss the joy as it flies. Do you remember that wonderful quatrain of Blake's? He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. That would be Ulro binding himself to the joy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. That's what Eden Eternity imagination can do. It doesn't need to possess because it always knows there's more, and that's the more that it can see. Ultimately, you know, it's about life that knows divine life. And so let me just show a final image that I hope captures something of this final state. I hope you can see that one there now. You know, this is the kind of image you might expect. It's called Heaven's Portals Opened, I think. And it's, you know, it's the human soul ascending joyously into the heavens through the Gothic arches with the angels there. And it's just full of vitality and sweep. More subtly, I think this is also an image of Eden Eternity. This is one of Blake's representations of Naomi and Ruth, the Old Testament story again. And this is when Naomi tells Ruth to go back to her own country. But Ruth says, no, I will stay with you now. And Blake thought that one of the key ways that we enter Eden Eternity is by what he called, rather dramatically, self-annihilation. And by what that he meant, in a way, was it wasn't quite denying the ego. Again, as I sort of mentioned at the beginning, I'm a bit suspicious of that way of putting it, because I think we're invited to be fully conscious in this state as much as in any other state. And not just invited, that's an essential part of the state. You know, we're invited to see our own divine nature. I'm liking the image from the book of Job there. But nonetheless, we're invited to continually sacrifice that awareness to a larger awareness, to others, so that it becomes a sort of springboard or a wellspring of ever wider vision, rather than limiting and constraining us like a pair of compasses. And I think that Blake's painted this moment between Ruth and Naomi where Ruth says, "No, I'm staying," because you see Ruth's sacrifice leading to their wider life together, that was going to enable. So it's a wonderful moment where that Ruth's, as it were, self-annihilation actually steps into a wider life. And of course, it's the trope of death leading to life that is so central to Christianity and other wisdom traditions as well. So the Eden Eternity is dynamic, and it really asks something tremendous of us as well. But in Eden Eternity, you have the imagination to know that this sacrifice always leads to more. And so you welcome it. It's not just a moral imperative. It's not certainly not something to be avoided. You start to see it as the path of life itself. So there's something about Ulro, Generation, Beulah, and Eden Eternity. And I presented it like that because I hope that it almost provides a kind of map through these different imaginative states. And rather than thinking, I must get Eden Eternity now, it's, I think the way to do it is much more to just to start to notice what state of mind you're in, and know that what Blake really aims is fluidity and change across these different states of mind. You know, Urizen, if you remember the blind god at the beginning, actually Urizen is in Eden Eternity. But in Eden Eternity, Urizen knows that reason serves discernment. It serves a bigger picture. It serves the imagination. And so then Urizen opens his eyes and shares in the joy. So, you know, Ulro and the lower states have their place. But when they know their place in relation to the higher states, then they become part of our freedom and not that which traps us.